This is a Monday afternoon, and we'll be together in about 4 hours. I thought that I would share some thoughts with you this afternoon, not about the immediate material that we've just talked about, an attempt to define consideration and to discuss why it may be that the doctrine of consideration exists at all as a predicate for the enforceability of promises, nor did I want to talk yet about the subject of how the principle of reliance has come to be viewed as a quite different approach to the question of the enforceability of promises. Instead, I thought I would talk a little bit about the rather odd organization of our course, in case you might be wondering. The most contracts courses, I have to acknowledge, begin with the question of whether or not the parties have reached agreement. The courses examine with care what we mean when we talk about mutual assent, and it's probably far more obvious why mutual assent would be a critical component of converting a promise into a contract than, let's say, consideration, a rather obscure doctrine of uncertain dimensions and of uncertain history and of uncertain future. Why would we not begin with mutual assent? And it gets even worse, because although we start with consideration, a second leg of the tripod, if you will, on which the enforceability of promises may stand, but we then, even after we finish consideration, we don't move on to mutual assent. No, instead we turn our attention to remedy. What happens, assuming you have an enforceable agreement, if one of the parties fails to perform, what remedies are available to the aggrieved party? And you might say, well, that surely puts the cart before the horse. Surely we ought to talk about all three legs of enforceability: mutual assent, consideration, and for certain classes of contracts, the existence of an adequate writing. Why shouldn't we talk about all three of those before we ever turn our attention to the question of remedy? And, oh yeah, shouldn't we first talk about the interpretation of contracts, how we know what it is that each party is required to do, and how do we measure whether the party has in fact adequately performed? Aren't we skipping over those if we go to talk about remedy, which assumes, of course, all those things? It assumes that there is an enforceable agreement. It assumes that a particular meaning of that agreement. It assumes that one of the parties has breached the agreement. And all those steps have to be examined before, in real life, we can ever talk about asking the court for a remedy. When Lon Fuller originally published this contracts casebook that we're using now, it was originally in its, when it was first created, it was the early 1950s. And Lon Fuller, who was who became later in life a fairly famous, not only as a contracts teacher, but also as a jurisprud, that is, as a philosopher of the law, He, when he brought out his casebook, he did something which was truly revolutionary and somewhat surprising. He began his casebook with the contracts casebook with the subject of remedies. Now you notice we don't begin there. We take it up second in the current version of this same Fuller casebook. And when he was asked about why in the world he started with the subject of remedies, his answer was that in his years of practice, when a client with a commercial problem, a problem having to do with contractual relations, when that client came into his office, the first question that his client asked was never, "Do you think there was mutual assent, counselor?" Nor was the first question, "Do you think there's adequate consideration to make this promise enforceable?" No. He didn't even ask for an interpretation of what the contract means. He didn't ask about the question of what we mean by breach. Instead, Lon Fuller said, my client wanted to know, if I've breached the contract, how much is it going to cost me? Or, since I think he breached the contract, how much can we get from him? And so Fuller said that since that's really what the client wanted to know, wouldn't that be a good place to start? Now, I think myself that that was a somewhat coy and unrevealing remark, although a humorous one, and maybe even factually true. But I think it's probably an apocryphal story, one he made up to make a point. I think that rather he had a pedagogical motivation in mind and a philosophical motivation in mind. In some ways, the most interesting aspect of contract law, and the thing about contract law that may say the most about our society, will be found when we talk about what remedies are available. We've seen just a little bit of that right now. We talked about expectation the other day in class and what that remedy means. It means trying to put the aggrieved party in the position, the economic position that they would have been in had the contract been performed. And when we turn our attention to reliance tonight, we're also going to be mentioning tonight or on Thursday night the remedy that is most often awarded in the event that a promise is enforced based upon the principle of reliance, and that is a remedy which, unsurprisingly, is called the reliance remedy. And we're going to talk about the similarities and differences between granting reliance remedies on the one hand and expectation on the other. I think that Lon Fuller thought it told us a lot about ourselves, it taught us a lot about our contract system. And since he was a philosopher, that's the point that he wanted to make. I think he also wanted to do something pedagogically. He wanted to begin with a body of law that is, while somewhat formulaic, that is, we'll study the formulas used to assess remedies. Much of it is not formulaic. Much of it is judgmental. Much of it deals with issues of what we mean by fairness. I think he did not want to begin the course with the subject of mutual assent, because as we'll see when we reach it in, January probably, or early February, mutual assent is rather formulaic. It does depend upon an observation of certain kinds of behaviors. It is dependent to a large extent on rules. And the rules make some sense most of the time. He didn't want students to begin learning contract law by learning specific and individual rules. He wanted to begin by having students understand contract law at its most important essence, that is, the philosophical underpinnings of our contract system. And so, now, because law students over the years found it too difficult to begin with the subject of remedies, the authors, the editors of this casebook since Fuller's passing, decided that they would begin with the topic he took up second, that is, the topic of consideration. It, too, has some philosophical components, and indeed we're going to be emphasizing those in this week, in tonight's class, on Thursday night's class. And it avoids very much the kind of formula rules that we'll see dominate mutual assent. By the time we reach mutual assent, there's no risk that you will think about contracts in any other way but in this way that approaches the question of the philosophy of contract itself, that is, why and how we enforce undertakings between persons. And when we talk about mutual assent, you'll be able to put those specific rules in that larger framework, which is the way I think Lon Fuller wanted you to see them. At any rate, when we finish the year and you look back at the order in which we took things, the order you'll see won't matter much, and I hope that you will arrive at a very full understanding of the whole contract system, even though we are taking it in what may seem to you and to other students a somewhat odd order.